So this is entirely a pedagogical lecture. There is, except for a little bit of reorganization of things that are known, if not necessarily easy to understand from the literature. There's nothing original in this. But I'm going to talk about a subject that I've been trying to educate myself on in the last month or two, partly because I'm writing up the chapter of my book that deals with these things right now, but largely because there are some really important planetary evolution questions that bear on the early Earth, Venus, extrasolar planets, for which one really has to understand the rate at which various components of an atmosphere can escape to space. There's a whole zoo of different mechanisms by which things can escape to space. This is a planet. It's supposed to be a sphere. But I'm going to talk about one particular one that plays a big role in loss of hydrogen from Earth-sized planets or Mars-sized planets and bigger. Which is hydrodynamic escape. Those of you, if anybody, Lance will recognize some of this stuff probably because you're in an aeronautics department, so you've probably seen the transonic area rule at some point. And the first time I saw the transonic area rule was when I was a graduate student in an aeronautics department, thinking, this is so nice, I'll probably never get a chance to use this now that I'm doing meteorology. I mean, what's supersonic in meteorology? And then just this year, there was the transonic area rule. So I was really delighted with this. This is half the reason for wanting to work on this, is so that I can make use of compressible aerodynamics. And it's really a neat problem altogether. But so an atmosphere consists of various constituents. You have some layer called the homosphere where things are mixed by turbulence, so that things don't segregate very much. All things are well mixed except for things that have a rapid removal mechanism like water vapor or things like methane that have some strong chemical reaction. But so you have some layer, and it's determined actually primarily by the amount of turbulence in an atmosphere. Diffusion increases with radius out from the planet because the mean free path goes up as you go because, well, diffusion increases with distance out farther because the density goes down, and so eventually diffusion wins. And when diffusion wins, different species diffuse at different rates and settle at different rates, and therefore you get gravitational segregation. Turbopause is probably the same thing as the homopause. Yeah, I actually hadn't heard the term turbopause, but I guess the homosphere would be the turbosphere. I guess the turbosphere is a better term than the homosphere because the homosphere is not actually homogeneous. It's only homogeneous for non-reactive species. So water vapor is anything but homogeneous in the homosphere. And ozone is very unhomogeneous in the homosphere. Now, it's an interesting thing, historical light here, a side light, is that it's so hard to understand turbulence from first principles, that when the stratosphere was first discovered, but before they had chemical constituent measurements, people thought the turbopause was the tropopause. That you could see that there was a lot of mixing in the troposphere, but it was the first thought that you would get gravitational segregation already in the stratosphere. Whereas in fact, you have to go to up to about 200 kilometers, between 100 and 200 kilometers before you actually start to see gravitational segregation. But so the story starts for whatever planet we're talking about. The story starts a couple hundred kilometers up where you are starting to see segregation of stuff. And where the planet is bathed in energetic photons that don't reach us farther down, because although there are very few extreme ultraviolet photons, they're absorbed by the stuff in the outer atmosphere before they get to us. And so the radiative environment is very different from what we're used to in the troposphere. And although the number of watts per square meter involved is very small out there in terms of this extreme ultraviolet, and the number of photons is rather small, the number of molecules is also rather small. And despite the fact that you're talking about a part of the atmosphere where the density is measured in kilometers, in kilograms per cubic kilometer, this is where the stuff escapes the space from. And so to solve the problem of how a planet's atmosphere evolves through escape to space, there are two parts. You have to know how rapidly you deliver things to the part where it can get out to space. And you also have to know how rapidly it escapes once it gets out there. And in different circumstances, either the rate of delivery to the escape region is the limiting factor. In other cases, it's the rate of loss. And so this provides the upper boundary condition for the transport processes lower down. So, there are a whole zoo of different escape mechanisms, and the composition of the outer atmosphere is determined partly by the transport from lower down, and partly by gravitational segregation. And so, an important thing. So, in terms of understanding what's out here that's escaping, the scale height goes like e to the minus the profile. Of number density of any substance, we call it A, and A of Z goes like e to the minus Z over some scale height, which is dependent on the species. And if it's isothermal, the scale height is Boltzmann's constant times the temperature divided by the mass, not the molecular weight, but the actual mass in kilograms of the molecule times g. And so lighter things like hydrogen or H2 have a bigger scale height. And since you have the miracle of exponential decay, you don't have to have more than a percent or so of hydrogen in your lower atmosphere before your outer atmosphere can be completely dominated by hydrogen. And so this is the sort of circumstance. Sorry?
Are you considering the neutral atmosphere?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In this talk, I will only be considering the neutral atmosphere.
The real atmosphere becomes ionized.
It becomes ionized further out, and yeah. That's right. And so I will only talk about the neutral escape. I've been actually quite afraid of talking about magnetic field. Actually, I mean, a lot of the literature on hydrodynamic escape has been just for neutral escape, partly because a lot of that literature evolved for Venus, which doesn't have a magnetic field now, although who knows about the past. But there is ionization up there, what a lot of people have been talking about in this context is escape of neutral hydrogen and escape of neutral H2, and then also helium. So I'm not going to touch the charged particles, but it's an interesting question. What charge would do to this calculation? I'm going to sketch out. Okay. So the light things tend to get near the top. The Earth's outer atmosphere, the Earth's exosphere, is actually dominated by atomic oxygen. There's not enough hydrogen that makes it up to this point to dominate the outer atmosphere of the Earth, because there's so much oxygen around right now that any hydrogen that you get out of volcanoes and so forth is sopped up by oxygen and turned into water vapor. And you might think that since nitrogen is the lightest species that at 28 molecular weight, that we'd have a nitrogen-dominated exosphere. But in fact, oxygen, O2, photolyzes into atomic oxygen at around 300 kilometers or so. And so it's the atomic oxygen that dominates the Earth's exosphere. For Venus, it's mostly CO2.
Yeah.
You do get tiny amounts of hydrogen out there, although out in regions which are it's essentially not collisional at all out there. You have little hydrogen corona out there.
But
actually, I don't know. I'm only 2 months into this.
Brings ions. The density of solar wind is very small.
Yeah, and it's very energetic, so it's hard to capture solar wind on the Earth. Okay, so now what all of this is about, again, in terms of losing constituents from an atmosphere, it's really all about escape velocity. So if you have 1/2 mv, we'll call it w, let it be the outward directed velocity, has to equal g times the gravitational constant times the mass of the planet, I'll call it m sub p, times m over R. That's the gravitational potential. Think of that as the surface. I mean, where it's the distance from which we're thinking of escape. And so the m's go out, and so you get escape velocity. And so the whole question in escape is how you impart enough energy to bring a particle up to escape velocity. And of course, it's much easier for light molecules to escape because you don't have to put in as much energy to accelerate them to escape velocity. Now, I mean, the thermal velocity kt doesn't give you very much escape. Even for hydrogen, it's not enough to do something like get rid of the hydrogen in Venus's ocean. On Titan, the escape just from the energy in KT is enough to be significant for hydrogen. But we're talking about only needing to get rid of rather small amounts. And so, and one of the problems with thermal escape is that when you put energy in to a gas and let it thermalize, it goes into all different directions. So some of your energy is wasted on inward directed motions. Secondly, you have a Gaussian distribution, which means that you have very low probability of things with energy, with velocity, with energy more than square root of kt, with energy more than k, the mean energy, the typical energy kt, because the Gaussian goes down very fast. And so the whole business of hydrodynamic escape is if you use, Maxwell distribution, yeah, the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And so this, the escape from thermal means, which is called Jeans escape, is extremely inefficient. It's not even very efficient for hydrogen on a planet the size of Venus, the mass of Venus. And so, the whole idea of hydrodynamic escape is if you can use energy, which ultimately comes from absorption of solar ultraviolet, if you can use energy more efficiently, if you put all your energy into an outward-directed jet, and all at sort of a kind of an optimal speed for escaping without wasting it on making some molecules slower, then you can actually sustain. You can actually, with the same amount of solar absorption, with the same amount of energy being absorbed, the same energy supply, you can sustain a greater mass flux. And that's the idea of hydrodynamic escape. For Mars size and bigger bodies, this is something that mostly we think about with regard to hydrogen. It's the only thing that's really light enough because you still have to bring things up to escape velocity. So you still need more energy to make oxygen and so forth escape. When you get to smaller bodies, if you're talking about habitable moons, what would happen to the atmosphere of Titan, of something like Titan, if it were in orbit around a giant planet that was in an Earth-like orbit? Then actually hydrodynamic escape of heavier things could start to become significant. And also for interesting exotic extrasolar planets like these things they call roasters, which are hot Jupiters, they're Jupiter-like things in very close orbits, they get so much solar radiation that you could potentially escape heavier things. So there's been very relatively little work on hydrodynamic escape from roasters. There's been more work on the solar wind interaction with roasters, and so today's story is really going to be mostly about hydrogen. Although the fluid dynamics I'll develop in principle applies to anything, you just have to ratchet up the energy enough to make something heavier, heavier go. Now, we're interested in a situation where you're absorbing some energy, solar, extreme ultraviolet, and then you're using it to sustain an outward jet. Okay, and I'll come back at the end to the issue of this outward jet. The formalism I'll explain is just for a purely radially symmetric, spherically symmetric jet outflow, and I'll mention some problems with that picture at the very end. But most of the almost all the calculations I've been able to find on planetary atmosphere evolution have been done with spherically symmetric cases, so that's what I'm going to explain. And I think there are good, interesting opportunities for looking at what happens when you're not spherically symmetric. And there's reason to believe that's quite important. So in terms of why this is important, you know, why this is interesting. So there's the sort of the history of Venus, so the standard picture of Venus. Though there are two pictures of Venus. One picture of Venus. Well, first of all, you should understand, Venus right now has almost no water vapor in its atmosphere, just absolute trace amounts. One picture of Venus is that it never had water vapor, that it was just formed dry because it was closer in and there wasn't as much ice around, there wasn't as much hydrated mineral. And that maybe, you know, what water vapor we have there now is from cometary input and so forth. And that's a minority view of Venus, but it's, you know, mainly because most planetary formation people seem to think that there's not a really strong argument for Venus being formed with less water than Earth. But it's a possible view. But the prevailing view of Venus is that Venus was formed with about as much of an ocean as the Earth. Being closer, it went into a full or partial runaway. So a runaway state, since water vapor is a greenhouse gas, you can get into a situation where the planet is not able to get rid of, is not able to increase its infrared emission by increasing its temperature, because when you increase the temperature by Clausius-Clapeyron, you increase the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, and that increases the greenhouse effect. On Earth, that effect only doubles climate sensitivity, but if you go all the way to a much moister atmosphere, you can get into a situation where the outgoing infrared radiation stops increasing with temperature. So it's not like sigma T to the fourth. And as long as you, and that process of that flat infrared emission versus temperature only stops and picks up again once you've evaporated your whole ocean into the atmosphere, which is the full runaway. Now it's thought that it's sort of thought now that clouds and subsaturation would prevent a true runaway state where you have no liquid on the surface, and that instead you have a situation where you have 2 or 3 bars of, or maybe up to 10 bars of steam atmosphere, but a very hot liquid surface, but you still have a steam-dominated atmosphere, water vapor-dominated atmosphere, which gives you a lot of water vapor high up where it can break apart. And so the question is, though, since there's no water vapor left in Venus right now, you've got to get rid of that somehow. And you have to get rid of a whole ocean worth of water vapor. And so how do you do that? And so this, you know, engages all sorts of questions about evolution, planetary evolution, but basically, you know, high up, H2O plus an ultraviolet photon goes to atomic hydrogen plus OH, and the OH undergoes further reactions. So it photolyzes. This reaction is, you can think of that as basically instantaneous. You can almost, you know, get it one for one. It's limited by the supply of photons and what other reactions are competing for those photons. It's not limited by reaction rates. But then the question is, if you split this up, can you get rid of the hydrogen fast enough that you can lose one ocean's worth of hydrogen? And then eventually this undergoes other reactions, you get rid of that hydrogen too. And you leave oxygen behind. Can you get rid of an ocean's worth of hydrogen in the age of the solar system? Okay, and that's not an easy thing to do. But so the escape rate of hydrogen, the escape rate of hydrogen constrains whether the runaway greenhouse picture of early Venus is plausible at all. There's been essentially just one calculation done on this, which was by Casting and Pollock in the 1980s. As far as I can tell, this has never really been revisited. I mean, it's been revisited a little bit by a guy named David Grinspoon, but
did you help with high increase of oxygen?
Did I what?
End up with higher.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because this oxygen is a major problem which interacts with the question of the surface history of Venus. There is no way to get rid of the oxygen by any escape. It's just too heavy. all these fancy escape mechanisms, charge exchange, dissociative recombination, solar wind interactions, they do cause loss of oxygen from Venus's exosphere today, but at nothing like a rate that would get rid of an ocean's worth of oxygen. Not even close, not even close, not even a percent of an ocean's worth of oxygen could be lost that way. And so you have an ocean's worth of oxygen that you have to get rid of. And so the only thought, the only way that's known to get rid of that is to react it with iron minerals in the crust. But for that to happen, you have to have enough recycling of crust to make weatherable surfaces available. And so you have to actually oxidize Venus down to a depth of 5 or 6 kilometers in order to sop up, or maybe even a little bit more, to sop up an ocean's worth of oxygen. And so whether you can actually plausibly get rid of that oxygen is a geochemical story and a tectonic story. There has to be a sufficient rate of resurfacing of Venus to provide new reactable surface in order to get rid of that oxygen. And right now it's very speculative. There are reactions that are known that can make iron minerals that would take up the oxygen. But as far as the kinetics of that, it's almost completely virgin territory. But it's not an escape story. That no one has any mechanism that could come close to getting rid of the oxygen.
Yeah.
Well, not plate tectonics.
Atlantis on Venus.
Yeah.
And we have planned mission.
Yeah.
In that area, which will land several probes.
Yeah.
Right on the surface. Maybe that will be a good
thing. Yes, because right now we know nothing there are these heroic Russian missions, the Venera missions, which were the only landers. They didn't actually provide mineralogy data from the surface.
Very short.
Very short-lived things. Yeah. So actually getting information about the mineralogy of the surface would be one of the biggest revolutions in understanding Venus. Right now, the radar data tells us there are volcanoes there, but one of the big disputes in the community is how recent is that volcanism? Are these old volcanoes? Are these all fairly recent? Some people look at the surface patterns of Venus and say the whole planet was resurfaced 500 million years ago in a catastrophic resurfacing. The catastrophic resurfacing would, if you got that every 500 million years or so, that would be a great way of getting rid of the oxygen. And so actually the whole question of what happened to the oxygen, it really is, it's inextricably tied up with the question of what style of resurfacing you have on Venus. They don't even know whether there's active volcanism on Venus right now.
Can you trap and CO2 to trap this ocean of oxygen always?
Well, there's not enough extra carbon around. I guess that's an interesting wrinkle. I would have to know more about planetary formation theory, but some people say that Mars was not, carbonates do not come from, do not come in as part of the accretion. They're formed later. So carbon actually comes into a planet largely in a form of various organics and maybe even graphite. And so some people say that, the carbon on, that there was never enough that there is not enough carbonate on Mars at any stage to sustain a dense CO2 atmosphere. And so I guess you could say, if you had a lot of primordial, not oxidized carbon, maybe the CO2 atmosphere could have come from oxidizing that. So that's an interesting question. Could you actually just use up some carbon to do that? I've never heard anyone suggest that. That's an interesting idea. But you need to oxidize something. So the typical idea is that you're oxidizing iron minerals, making iron minerals, iron oxides of various sorts. It's hard to rule out. Maybe there was oxidizable carbon in there. But then a really interesting thing, something that really sparked my interest in this was an interesting paper that appeared in Science a few years ago by Tian et al., where they revisited the question of escape of hydrogen from the early Earth. And so if you go back say 2 billion years before the oxygenation of the Earth's atmosphere. Then the hydrogen, that the H2 that outgasses from volcanoes, wouldn't be oxidized, and so it would accumulate in the lower atmosphere, diffuse upwards, and then the amount of hydrogen you have in the atmosphere is a balance between the rate of outgassing. You build up enough hydrogen until the rate of outgassing equals the rate of loss. And so since the rate of loss is proportional to the concentration out here in the exosphere, the loss coefficient determines how much hydrogen you have. And this paper actually revised by about a factor, revised the loss rate calculation by a factor of 10 downwards, based on a different assumption about the temperature of the outer planet and a different way of doing the hydrodynamics. And this also needs to be thought about more carefully, because this is a major change in the conception of the chemistry of the early Earth atmosphere, and it's connected with the genesis of life too, because there was the old Urey Miller experiment where you take methane and ammonia and you zap it with lightning or other sources of energy, and you create organic molecules, amino acids and so forth. But in the current picture of the formation of the Earth, the core segregated too quickly, so you couldn't actually get reduced compounds outgassing at a very big rate. So the idea of a prebiotic methane ammonia atmosphere is not very plausible anymore. And you can't, when you zap CO2 with lightning, it just doesn't do very much. On the other hand, Maggie Tolbert at Colorado showed that if you zap high concentration hydrogen mixtures with CO2, you zap that with lightning, the discharge, you do get prebiotic synthesis. And so, in fact, the main focus on this paper, the main reason they were interested in hydrogen, was because it gave you another pathway to prebiotic synthesis. But having large amounts of hydrogen changes all sorts of things about atmospheric chemistry. For example, it actually really sucks up oxygen. You always create a little bit of oxygen by photolysis, but if you have a lot of hydrogen around, it really tends to keep down the oxygen. So you have really anoxic atmospheres, which changes things like the oxidation rate of methane. And so the presence of hydrogen actually plays a big role in methane chemistry. If you have a lot of hydrogen around, you can't actually convert methane into ethane nearly as efficiently. And so it changed, you know, it really is important. It has a lot of implications whether there's 1% of hydrogen in the atmosphere like people used to think, or 20% of hydrogen like Chiana et al. Were thinking. So that's one of the main things. I mean, there is an issue, you know, there are some questions about Titan. In Titan, you convert methane into ethane, and each conversion of methane into ethane releases one hydrogen that you have to get rid of. Right now, you can actually pretty much get rid of it by thermal escape of hydrogen. But if you were thinking about, if you're running the whole thing at a somewhat higher temperature, or with a greater rate of production, there might actually be a hydrogen blow. You might accumulate enough hydrogen in the outer atmosphere that you would go into this hydrodynamic state instead of a genes escape, which would then carry lots of heavier things with it. But that's something else I wanted to just mention, though I won't quantify it, that if you have an outward jet, it's like cloud particles. You have a settling speed, which is relative to the flow. And so the outward jet actually has the effect of increasing the scale height of heavier things. In some cases, if the outward jet is fast enough, it can actually blow heavier things out with it. But if it's not fast enough, at least it can increase the scale height and make it easier for other escape mechanisms like solar wind and so forth to interact with it. And finally, I'll just remark that actually the theory of hydrodynamic escape is almost identical. It's very similar to the theory of solar wind formation. In fact, the fluid dynamics was first worked out for the solar wind, which turned out to be an easier case because all the heating is near the bottom, and then later extended, I think, by Chamberlain to planetary winds. So there are all those reasons for wanting to know about hydrogen escape. And so to actually try to understand this, you start with the momentum equation. Okay, we don't have to talk. There's no radiation in the momentum equation, so we don't even have to talk about heating. So if W is the outward directed velocity, and I'll just have it as r. The momentum equation is w times dw by dr. That's just the, oh yes, this is going to be for steady flow. So there's no partial derivative. And then there's just a pressure gradient term, minus 1 over rho dp by dr. And then the gravitational term, minus g times the mass of the planet over r squared. Okay, where r is the radial distance from the center of the planet, not the altitude. And so the interesting thing is, you know, if you have heat coming in from radiation, there are really two equilibrium states, two classes of equilibrium states you could have. And it's an interesting question, you know, what determines which one you settle into. So you could have a situation where you have a local radiation balance, where the absorbed solar radiation is balanced by infrared emission. And CO2 is a good infrared emitter. And so you can actually, say, balance the absorption of ultraviolet by CO2 with the emission of infrared by CO2. And so you could have a local balance where there's no net heating. And the temperature is just determined by what temperature you have to have to radiate enough to what's coming in. So you could have a situation where the temperature is just determined by local radiation balance and W is zero, and then this equation just becomes hydrostatic balance. But you could also have a situation where the dominant balance is not between absorption and radiation. Instead, the dominant balance could be between absorption and then outward advection of energy by the velocity. And this is a very similar, this is conceptually similar to the problem of the Hadley circulation. In the Hadley circulation, you have different amounts of solar radiation absorbed at different latitudes in the tropics. You could have a situation, you have a perfectly good steady state in which you go into local radiative convective equilibrium, where at each latitude separately, with no transport to other latitudes, the amount of radiation absorbed is emitted locally. Okay, but you also have the circulation. You can also have a situation where this gradient can drive a circulation, can drive an overturning circulation, which transports heat from one place to another. And for the Hadley cell, there's a realizability condition based on angular momentum. You can't create angular momentum from nothing. In the case in which you don't, in which the static solution with local radiative equilibrium is excluded, is the case where the thermal wind that goes along with that has more angular momentum than is available. So it's a possible steady state, but it's not one you can reach from the state of rest. I haven't found as clean a criterion in this case. There's some aspects of the energy conservation that do constrain whether it's possible to have a net outward circulation. But it's similar in flavor. The dynamics can disrupt a balance, and it's a question of whether when you heat it up you go into the hydrostatic balance or whether you go into an advective state. Okay. It's a steady flow, and so the radial mass flux is independent of r. And so to connect it with aerodynamics, the area of a shell is 4 pi r squared, but I'm just going to write that as a of r, so I can apply the same equations to a tube, flow in a tube, rho times a of r times w, and that has to be a constant. Okay. So now, some useful thermodynamics.
Assume that it is a jet. You don't explain why it is.
Well, I'm going to say under what circumstances can I find a jet that is compatible with all of my constraints? And that doesn't actually resolve the question of whether you must go into that state. And that's something that I haven't seen any simulations really address. There have been relatively few initial value problems done for this. And doing initial value problems for this rather than steady state would really illuminate this question of what determines, you know, which end state you wind up in. Okay, so I'm going to do all of this for an ideal gas, which is good enough actually for the exosphere. But everything generalizes. So, first of all, okay, So here are some useful thermodynamics that I'll keep on the board because I'll come back to them. So there's the entropy per unit mass, C sub P, times the natural log of the potential temperature, where the potential temperature is equal to the actual temperature times P over some reference pressure, which I'll take to be, you know, the pressure at sort of the base of the region that I'm thinking of as my escape region. You could almost take it as the surface, to the minus R over C sub P, where R is the gas constant for the gas in question, which is hydrogen. There's a very important role of supersonic versus subsonic flow, so we need to know the speed of sound. The speed of sound is the adiabatic constant gamma times the gas constant times temperature, where gamma is equal to R over is equal to C sub P over C sub V. And then you can also write this adiabatic constant. You can write that constant R over C sub P as 1 minus 1 over gamma. Okay. So now the rest of this whole business amounts to rewriting this pressure gradient term in various ways that allow us to deduce interesting things. So I won't subject you to the, you know, to all the derivations, just using these thermodynamic relationships, you can rewrite this term as you can rewrite that term as P over rho, the density, times d by dr of the natural log of P over P naught. You can see you can relate that to the entropy now, and that can be rewritten as C squared, just using thermodynamics, times the d of ln theta dr minus C squared times the derivative of the natural log of rho by dr. That's just using the perfect gas law and the definition of the entropy. And now this we constrain using the mass flux. So you can get a relationship between the wind and the current and the mass flux and the area and the density. And so if you take the log of that, and since phi is constant, then just take the derivative of that, the left-hand side is zero, and you get a relationship between the derivative of log rho, the derivative of area, and the derivative of w. Okay, and this looks just like aerodynamics in a tube, except for that gravitational term. So when you just go through that arithmetic, you go through that arithmetic, and then substitute for this derivative of log rho, what you wind up with is the relationship w minus c squared over w, or actually I can write it as 1 minus c squared over w squared times w dw by dr is equal to, it's a rather nice relationship, c squared times the derivative of the natural log of a of the area over theta, theta being the potential temperature, by dr, minus the gravitational term, which I can write as 1/2 times the escape velocity squared over r. Okay. This thing is 1 over the Mach number squared. The speed divided by the speed of sound is the Mach number. And so we get the area rule that if there's a strong constraint saying under what circumstances you can make the transition from subsonic to supersonic smoothly. If you want dw by dr to be non-singular, then that means that where you're at Mach 1, the right-hand side has to vanish. Okay. And so, at Mach 1, then you have 0 equals this right-hand side. That's a version of the transonic area rule with gravity in it. And this equation is valid even if you have heating. If you have no heating, the entropy is constant. Theta is constant, and so that can be dropped out of there. And if you have no gravity, this can be dropped out. But this form of the transonic area rule is valid even if you have heating, let's say by combustion or by absorption of solar radiation. And heating changes theta, and so an increase in theta is like a constriction. It's like a reduction in the area, which will be very important from the standpoint of this application of the transonic area rule. I'm going to give you. Okay. So now, why is Mach 1 important? Well, you start off where the density is high down here. You start off subsonic. Up to a fairly high altitude, you're pretty close to hydrostatic equilibrium. So you definitely starting off subsonic. Why can't you just have a subsonic escape? Because it is a valid steady solution. Now the reason in the literature, the subsonic solutions are considered unphysical because they have finite pressure at infinity, so that for the steady state to exist, you have to have the interstellar medium having, or the interplanetary medium having, some pressure. That's the argument there. In the supersonic solutions patch neatly into outer space without having to think about what's going on out there in space. What's more, when you're supersonic, you don't need a boundary condition at infinity, because when you're supersonic, the problem is hyperbolic at infinity. So anything you do at infinity doesn't affect the loss rate. It doesn't sort of propagate backwards. You get a nice, consistent, steady solution when you go supersonic. So you have to go through the transonic point to do that. Now, having said that, I certainly agree with the literature that the steady subsonic solution is unphysical. You basically have to fill the whole interplanetary medium with mass to do that. But it's not so clear to me what happens in the transient case. I mean, if it's going to go subsonic, if you do an initial value problem and you don't go through the transonic point, does that just mean that your whole atmosphere just shoots off into space? This notion that only the supersonic solution is physical is very much embedded in literature on this. But I'm still a little bit fuzzy on the physical justification of that, except to say that...
That sounds like a good point. Yeah. Well, we expect a jet, it's like volcanic explosion.
Yes, right.
Which is transient.
Yeah.
And you don't need to care about boundary conditions.
That's exactly. And so the thinking about why the subsonic solution should be rejected comes from just looking at a steady state. You could resolve this issue very nicely by just doing an initial value problem in one dimension, which is not a hard problem on computers these days. But so anyway, let me get to this to the transonic area rule. Let's do flow in a tube. This is an amazing constraint. I mean, this seems completely counterintuitive. So this is a tube with an area A of R, where I'm using as R. R is just the distance along the tube. Okay. So you're putting in some stuff here that's subsonic, and you'd like to accelerate it. You'd like to accelerate it to be supersonic. And so you might think that you could just make a funnel like this, and that a nozzle like that would give you supersonic flow if you just made the constriction enough. But that's not at all the way it works. If you take the case where theta is equal to a constant and there's no gravity, so we drop the gravity term, then the transonic area rule simply says that zero equals, okay, and theta is constant, says that zero is equal, and then c squared is non-zero there. So the transonic area rule says that where where W over C equals 1, where you have Mach 1, then d by dr of the natural log of area, which means basically d by d log of the area has to be 0. So you have to be at a minimum.
So
they need gravity to create level. So that's right. So to do this on the Earth, you need gravity. To do this on a planet, you need gravity. Or actually, you can do it with increasing theta instead. So it means that you can't actually make a supersonic jet with just a sort of a conical nozzle like that. In order to make it supersonic, the transonic point has to be at a minimum of area, place where d area by the length equals 0. And that actually, if you've seen the movie October Sky or read the book Rocket Boys, there's one part where they have to learn calculus because they want to design a transonic nozzle, which is better than the subsonic nozzles they've been using. And it's hard to machine, but in fact, the whole design of the transonic rocket nozzle is so that the Mach 1 point is at the constriction. Otherwise, in fact, if you try to do this, then in fact, there's no steady solution. What will happen is, since you're subsonic here, the conditions here will affect the upstream boundary condition and adjust it in such a way that that it's compatible with energy conservation. You can do that because it's subsonic in this region. And so, in fact, you get this phenomenon called choking. Literally, if you try to force flow here in such a way that it's supersonic going out the other way, it just won't go. It'll create back pressure and your device will explode or things will leak out. And my thesis advisor, Sheila Widnall, had an interesting consulting job with some company that was trying to do supersonic rayon, trying to make rayon with a supersonic jet. And they didn't know about the transonic area rule, and they just had all this reactant spraying out all over the place. And what in the world is going on? I mean, we made this nozzle that looks like that. But, you know, so that was pretty easy money that she made. But the transonic area rule. So you have the same condition. You can't just go through a transonic point just anywhere. You have to meet these special conditions. And so when you put the gravity back into it, there are two things that allow you to meet those conditions for escaping wind on a planet. One thing that acts like a constriction is heating, which increases theta. Okay, so A for the Earth is 4 pi r squared. For a planet, it's 4 pi r squared. So that's just monotonically increasing, so you don't get a constriction from that. But you can help to meet a transonic area rule condition, a transcritical condition, with increasing theta in the right place. Or you can also do, even if it's adiabatic, so theta is constant, you can do it with this gravity term. And so the gravity acts like a constriction. Now, if you plug in the numbers, I'm running short on time, so I won't, you know, go through the details of plugging in the numbers. But if you try to make an adiabatic supersonic escaping jet, in other words, if you set theta equals constant, and you balance this term, against this term, with A equals 4 pi r squared to find out what temperature you need at the transonic point in order to meet that condition for Earth-like values. You find, remember, C squared is proportional to the temperature. So knowing C squared is like knowing the temperature. You need a temperature of 5,000 degrees in order to match this transonic condition if it's adiabatic. And so if you had a very hot planet like a Roche, if you had, so you wouldn't actually need radiative heating if you're very hot. But in the kind of temperatures you get in Venus or Earth or Mars, you would not actually be able to match the transonic condition when it's adiabatic. And so heating plays a very important role in sustaining the escape. But in the solar wind case, which was worked out by Eugene Parker at University of Chicago, in fact, there's enough heating, it's hot enough, that they can get a pretty good representation of the formation of the solar wind, you know, just by using adiabatic theory. Most of the heating is sort of near the beginning where the action is starting up. You give it a good launch, It can go through the transonic point at 5,000 some Kelvin. Well, it's a different temperature because it's different gravity. It goes through the transonic point, and so you can get to first base with adiabatic theory for the solar wind. It's also charged, so you have to think about those things. The way that affects the equation of state, but yeah.
I mean, adiabatic theory gives you an answer to what you mean.
It does, yeah. It's constant theta, and so that in fact is when you what happens is, in fact, this is what I'll show you now. What happens is, if you start off with a temperature that's too low, then when you have adiabatic flow. Constant theta, you're just going on the adiabatic lapse rate, the dry adiabatic lapse rate, which reaches zero pressure and zero temperature at some finite radius. And so as the temperature goes down, the Mach number goes up because the speed, this speed of sound is going down. And so the thing that chokes off adiabatic escape on the Earth is simply that it cools down too much, and then you hit the transonic point before you go to low temperatures, so you don't hit these high temperatures that you need. You have to start with temperatures a lot higher than 5,000 in order to hit 5,000 at the transonic point. But you're absolutely right. It's the same adiabatic pattern that you would get. And so, just to give you an idea, just to show you that in action, this sort of cooling, how this looks in terms of energy, because you can do the calculation. You can rewrite that pressure gradient term using the first law of thermodynamics, which then gives you an energy conservation relationship instead of the transonic area rule. It gives you a flux law. So let's not go through that derivation. But it can give you an energy curve. You can write the energy as a function of the Mach number with coefficients that depend on the flux, the mass flux phi. So in all of these problems, the mass flux comes in not as a boundary condition, but it's a nonlinear eigenvalue. Essentially, you have to adjust the mass flux so that you meet the transonic condition plus whatever initial conditions on at R naught on density and so forth. So in both the cases with heating, without heating, the mass flux is the thing you adjust to match what you want. So let me show you what happens for Earth-like temperatures or Venus-like temperatures when you have when you try to do it purely adiabatically, and then I'll just show you some results for what things look like when you put in some heating that increases state. When you put in heating, you just have to solve for the entropy increase with radius. But so these are adiabatic cases. So let me show you the energy curve. So when you write the energy as a function of Mach number, you find that the energy goes to infinity at zero Mach number, and it goes to infinity at large Mach number, and then there's a minimum in between. If I specify the mass flux, and here I've normalized it in terms of kilograms per square meter per second, if I plot the energy curves versus Mach number for a potential temperature of 300 Kelvin, a mass flux of 10 to the minus 9 kilograms per square meter per second, and then we'll do it for, say, a bunch of different radii going from normalized by the Earth's radius, and this is for H2, Earth's radius, we'll do 2, 3, 4, so out to 4 Earth radii, and then let's see what you get. Okay, this is for close in. The blue curve is farther out, and the next yellow curve is at 3 Earth radii and 4 Earth radii. So the curves are going up. Let me actually put in a different value where I think you can get, let me try minus 6 to minus 7. you can actually see that increase near Mach number 0. So this is the energy. Yeah, this is a little bit better. So this is the energy. This is the Mach number here. This is Mach 10. This is Mach 0. There's a singularity near Mach 0, and then the minimum is always occurring at Mach 1, like it should. And so this is when you're close in. And so if you have an initial, if you start off with an initial Mach number like this, and you start, this is the subsonic side, this is the supersonic side, there are two solutions for a given, energy. And so if I start off in the this subsonic branch here, as I increase R, as I go further out, this curve evolves into this. And so then my solution winds up at Mach 1 at one of these curves that goes through like that. But then, I'm doing the intersection with this curve here. These curves are now have energy higher than the energy. There's no solution for those. So
what? Can you repeat?
This is the energy. There's an energy quantity, which is independent of radius, and so it's conserved going outwards.
Energy,
okay.
What?
It's the energy. It's the kinetic plus potential energy of the gas. And so you can and you can write that through a few manipulations as a function of the Mach number. It goes up. In fact, I'll redo it so that you can actually see the intersection a little bit better. I'll do it in a smaller range. Of radii.
So to evaporate, you need to put it to what? To zero?
Well, now the problem is actually it goes to zero. Let's see. Is there a pointer here? I need a stick of some sort. Here's a stick. Yeah, right. So I'll show you the temperature as a function of distance. So what happens here? Because of this energy is conserved, it's constant in radius. It's constant. You keep the same value of energy as you go out to larger r. And so this is one Earth radii. This is 1.1, 1.2. And so here there's a solution there, and there's a supersonic solution there. As you increase the radius, you move into this blue curve. As you go farther out, you move into this blue curve. You hit Mach 1. Okay, so you do hit Mach 1, but you don't meet the transonic area rule. And what happens is these two solutions coalesce. W has a square root singularity at that point. And then when you go to larger radius, there's no solution, which means that, in fact, with this mass flux that I've chosen, there's no solution that has a non-zero velocity going out. So it's inconsistent. So the mass flux has to be zero. And so in fact, when you use temperatures that are like 300 Kelvin, that are below 5,000 or so, then you always get into the situation where the curves move up with radius, and there's no consistent solution. If you go to these very high temperatures, you can get the case where the curves start high, they go down, and then they go back up again. They start low, they go up, and they go back down again, so you can make the transition. So in other words, in order to make the transition from the subsonic branch to the supersonic branch, let's say my energy is this, you have to move this curve up to here, but instead of continuing it on, you have to move it back down. And that's the geometry that the transonic area rule guarantees. You move it up and you move it back down. And so if I use the same solver to show you how the Mach number and the temperature depend on radius. In other words, if I compute those intersection points, so this is the Mach number and this is the radius in Earth radii going from 1 to 1.01. There's Mach 1 at the top, and there's the square root singularity of the Mach number, and hence the velocity with position. And then this is the temperature. And this illustrates Olivier's point that you're just on the dry adiabat. I started off at 300, and I've gone down to a temperature of 230 Kelvin, at which point I hit Mach 1, and then I can't actually get past. But you don't actually go down to zero here. You can hit Mach 1 before you run out of atmosphere. It's the Mach 1 barrier, it's the sound barrier that limits these things. Okay. So, but still, this solution. is a hydrodynamic escape solution, or that is this equation gives you hydrodynamic escape, but just at too high a temperature. So you don't get, so with, and so you can't do it adiabatically. And so so the last thing I'll just show you is what happens when you put in radiative heating. And I put in a simple model of radiative heating. I put in a simple model of radiative heating.
How much time does it take?
Well, I mean, actually, I can quote numbers from other people. So actually, you don't evaporate the, it's not a question of evaporating the atmosphere, we're only getting rid of hydrogen. And so what we're interested in is the escape coefficient that says, that gives you the proportionality between escape mass and the concentration. We're looking for equilibria. You have a certain source of hydrogen. Okay, I see what you mean. For the hydrogen outgassing balance for early Earth is an equilibrium condition, is an equilibrium problem. The ocean escape problem for Venus is a transient one. So the limiting step in Venus is the rate of losing hydrogen, and it takes about 2 billion years to lose on Casting's calculations for what they're worth. Which are done using a formalism like this with real radiative transfer. Casting and Pollock's calculations say that something like 2 billion years are needed in order to lose an ocean on Venus. But that number could go could move around by a factor of 2 or 5 or maybe even more when if you start re-examining it. But so let me just show you what kinds of in parting, let me just show you what the solutions look like when you and how you approach the solutions when you do have heating. Okay, when you have heating, we have radiative heating. That energy level surface. There are two things happening, which make it a little bit complicated to think about geometrically. But when you have heating, that constant energy that I showed you to give you the intersections, that's no longer constant because when you absorb radiation, you move that energy up. And so although the curves are going up, instead of making the curves go down and back up again, you can make the curves go down, give you a solution, and then as the curves go back up, and then if the curves are going the wrong direction, you can increase the energy level with the heating to chase the curves upwards. And then and the system has to wind up at a place where you hit the transonic point, where you just kiss the minimum of the curve at a place where the transonic condition is satisfied. But the second thing that heating does is it causes the potential temperature to increase with radius. So you're actually adjusting two things of the in these curves. The potential temperature changes the shape of the curves, and then the radiative heating moves the point of intersection up and down. And so you have to adjust it so that they both go together. Okay, and so in the last 2 minutes or so, and I think I will really try to end in 2 minutes, I'll just show you some of these solutions with heating to give you an idea of how you approach it. And one of the difficulties, because in fact, in Casting and Pollock's paper on hydrogen escape from early Venus, they did not actually manage to find the solution that goes supersonic. What they found was a subsonic solution that comes close to Mach 1. And they assumed that the mass loss from the subsonic solution was approximately the same as the transonic solution. And that's not entirely true because the density structure past the transonic point affects the radiative heating. And so that can shield heating that should be closer in. And nobody, as far as I know, has actually gone back to that Venus problem and found the true transonic solution. And it's partly because the radiative transfer depends on density, and it's actually hard to iterate and actually find a solution. You're looking in a pretty big nonlinear space. But the Tian and Pavlo, when they did this for the Earth, they didn't try to find the steady state. They integrated the transient aerodynamics to some kind of quasi-steady state, although they don't describe the nature of the transients. They don't even say whether it's transient or whether it finds a steady state. But in terms, as far as the Venus calculation goes, actually, as far as I know, we don't actually have a successful transonic solution. And I'll show you some of the challenges in finding it in this last graph, if I can. Let's see. I picked out a nice parameter before. 2.0866115 e minus 9. Okay, so now I'm doing a slightly more elaborate calculation because I have a simple model of the heating profile, and so I have to actually integrate the entropy equation to know what the, but that's the only differential equation I have to integrate. I have to integrate the first order entropy equation in order to get the log theta as a function of radius, and so then I do all the same intersection business, but with the right changing entropy and so forth. Okay. So this has a rather fairly high radiative heating. Okay, and so this is the subsonic solution. This is the Mach number versus radius. So there's one Earth radius, there's six, and I have picked if I pick a lower so this is with a flux. So I picked a mass flux. As I change the mass flux, I move this curve up and down. So with a lower mass flux, it's more subsonic. It goes like that. As I increase the mass flux more and more, this starts to hit Mach 1, right there. Okay, and that's my transonic point. And then this is the Mach number coming down on the same subsonic branch. And so I don't make the transition. And so this, in some sense, is the determination of my nonlinear eigenvalue. I pick all the other constants, the radiative heating, and so forth. And then I have to adjust the mass flux until my subsonic solution just comes up to there. So now there's another branch up here that you have to make the transition to. And so it's actually very hard to hit Mach 1 exactly because everything is singular at Mach 1. So instead, I have a little bit of a discontinuity, and I try to minimize the discontinuity. So I managed to do, this is a simpler radiative model than Kassing and Pollock used, but I managed to at least get the transonic solution. Sorry, what was that?
Why maximum at particular number 3?
Oh, it's that comes out of the solving the differential equation. You get the Mach number as a function of radius.
There's no plane.
What? No. This is the surface of the planet is at one Earth radii. It says that you have to go to 3 Earth radii from the surface before you hit Mach 1. So this is the distance. Sorry, not 3 Earth radii from the surface, 3 Earth radii from the center. So it's 2 Earth radii from the surface.
And
that's just coming from the flux condition, right? And so if you change the heating rate, if you change the initial temperature, you change that position. So the two things you get out of this are the flux, which determines, so the mass flux, you adjust so that you come as close as possible to this transcritical point. And then the other thing you adjust is then the calculation gives you what radius that occurs at. And so let me just show you what happens when I switch over to the supersonic branch and try to minimize the the jump, the discontinuity, the singularity. This flag true says to switch to the supersonic branch. It did it. It's finicky. I mean, I actually had to work on this several days before I actually was able to zero in on where I could do it. So let me do plot the Mach number again. So there I am. The scale is different because it goes supersonic, but here, so here is there is the transonic point 3, because I didn't exactly hit Mach 1. That little difference between Mach 1 gives me this jump, and it's actually this is about as close as I could get, and I couldn't actually get convergence. But as you get closer and closer to Mach 1, presumably this little diddle in here would go away. And this discontinuity here, this is where the heating cuts off. I used a heating that I assumed that where the atmosphere gets thin, there's no more absorption. And so here you're not expanding adiabatically because you're heating as you go out. Here you hit the here I just specified that at 4 my heating goes to zero. In casting, they make the heating a function of the density and so forth instead. And so out here, the Mach number really zooms up because your temperature is going down. Here is an example of a transonic solution and the determination of the flux in terms of the parameters as a kind of nonlinear eigenvalue problem. Now what is the problem with all of this? The main problem with all of this is that this flux is driven by ultraviolet absorption. You're in a part of the atmosphere with low density and almost no thermal inertia, and you only have sunlight during the day. It's insane to do a spherically symmetric calculation of this, except that it's what you can do. I mean, it's hard enough to do this SETI calculation spherically symmetrically, okay? But to do it in the real case is even harder. You have to do it in a transient solution. But the real system would not have a radially symmetric outflow. The real system would have this big sunward-directed jet at the subsolar point on the day side. Some of that would escape, and some of that would escape very quickly because you have very high radiant intensity there. But a lot of that is going to go around to the night side. In fact, you can see that circulation on Venus today in what they call the infrared air glow. You create atomic oxygen on the day side. It actually evects around to the night side. It doesn't escape, and then it recombines there and gives you an infrared air glow. And so hydrogen escape would be like that, except that it's light enough that some of the jet would escape, but a lot of the rest of it would go around to the cold night side. And so, as far as I can tell, although solar wind people have actually done quite a lot of 3D simulations, as far as the planetary wind goes, given that this paper by Tian, which shook up the whole picture of the early Earth, was done using a transient 1D simulation. To really address the question of whether they're right, what the hydrogen escape rate is, you really have to do this in a 3D transient simulation, or maybe some kind of axisymmetric simulation, cylindrically symmetric simulation. And so that's a real frontier. That's one reason I think with modern computers, you can actually do these 3D transonic simulations. It's a big simulation, but it's not particularly bigger than Navier-Stokes things.
That makes sense for the Earth, because Earth has magnetic field, and all perfectly different conditions compared to Venus, all the calculations.
Well, I mean, actually, in...
applicable
directly. Most of the literature, I mean, including the literature on escape of hydrogen from Earth, has been done with neutrals rather than with ions. Actually, one of the criticisms by Catling wrote a response to Tian et al., pointing out that, saying that you really have to consider ions. And ionization and the interaction with the magnetic field.
So even if we
just go to say Venus and say that there's no magnetic field, although early on there might have been one, if we just go to Venus and content ourselves with that, then to understand the rate of hydrogen loss from Venus, these symmetrical solutions are not the right ones to give you an answer. I mean, we really need some indication of the 3D structure of this escaping flow. But then you can also add on. Now, my inclination for Earth would be at least to see how much the 3D structure, the jet structure, would change the escape picture for neutrals. And then and that would tell us something about whether when you do the problem with charged particles in, it's sufficient to get an estimate from spherically symmetric flow, or whether you have to do it fully three-dimensionally. I'd sort of approach it in steps, but I agree, you have a lot of ions there. You have an interaction with magnetic field. You probably have some interaction with the solar wind as well. That gets really hairy, but this is hairy enough. But given that people are publishing papers about the chemical structure of the early Earth using the spherically symmetric thing, it seems that the least we could do is at least do what we know how to do and do it in two dimensions or three dimensions and try to get some answer of how the fluid dynamics of that is different.
On the sun, when we have solar wind,
yep.
We don't need jets.
Yeah.
We have a Laval nozzle.
Yeah.
Are created by gravity.
That's right, yeah.
So effectively, you create now, but Barclay solution was carried in a scenario.
Yeah.
Why the hell we need this concept?
It's because of the way the heating is with the sun. The heating it is spherically symmetric from the bottom. And although even for the sun, I mean, because of the magnetic field interaction, because it's a charged stream, things go out in the plane of the ecliptic at a different rate than they go the other way. But the but for the sun, the you can get to first base with a spherically symmetric case because the heating is from the bottom. Whereas for the planets, the heating is from extreme ultraviolet and it comes from the sun, so it's only on the day side. There's a day side, night side asymmetry. So it's a matter of where the sun is. Yeah.
Yeah. What is the radiative mechanism? There's no pressure broadening at these high
altitudes. Yeah, it's not even LTE. It's not even local thermodynamic equilibrium. So, but
half a year is not a jet.
Yeah, yeah. So what was that?
A day is a half. Yeah. Year not a jet.
It's yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know what the right. When I say jet, I mean, at the subsolar point, you have very intense heating. And so my thought, you know, is that you might get some kind of a jet streaming out from the subsolar point. Okay. Well, so you don't have to call it a jet, but let's just say a stream. We call it a stream, not a jet. It might not be like it's not like a galactic jet. It's, you know, so, but yeah.
He didn't try to find his way through that sun.
Well, he essentially, since it was that was adiabatic, he basically started at the transonic point, and then worked backwards from there. Yeah.
He did jump.
Yeah. Yes,
but then.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean,
what he said was. Let's assume that we have a transfer.
No, he put a diagram.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to know how the history works. Because, I mean, I know Parker. I never went back to read Parker's original paper. I know it through things that worked into the textbooks, and this is my impression. But the question about the radiation.
He didn't do it by flying his way from the sun.
You don't have to. You can do it with the adiabatic case. You can do it purely graphically. This is only necessary because I have heating and I have to integrate the entropy equation. To find this trajectory. His case, you can actually do purely graphically, and you don't have to do this at all. Yeah, you can just graphically. You look at intersections with that energy surface. But to get to your question about the radiation, actually. So it's not local thermodynamic equilibrium, and you have very infrequent collisions. So it's more like particle colliders out there, but still you have all the usual transitions. So for Venus, you have carbon dioxide, and so the carbon dioxide gets excited through absorption of a UV photon, and it may break up, or it may then radiate infrared. The only thing is that you don't have Doppler broadening very much. You don't have much Doppler broadening, but. Well, actually, on the Earth, you do have a fair amount of Doppler broadening because the Earth's exosphere is oxygen, and the oxygen gets very hot. But CO2 is the things that are good radiators are still good radiators even without collisions. And so Venus has a cold exosphere because CO2 can radiate pretty well. And one of the things, wrinkles that was in this Tian et al. Paper in Science was the recognition that if the early Earth had a high CO2 atmosphere, we would have a CO2, we might have a CO2 dominated exosphere also, instead of atomic oxygen, which would be a lot colder because it radiates better. An atomic oxygen exosphere like we have on Earth right now absorbs a solar ultraviolet very well. It's a very poor infrared radiator, so it goes up to 1,000 Kelvin before it's in equilibrium. So, but the main difference is difference between the radiative transfer we're used to thinking of is that these are really isolated quantum transitions, and it's not in local thermodynamic equilibrium. So, in some ways it's an easier calculation because you just have the a molecule in an excited state, and then you just use the QED coefficients to determine the Einstein A and B coefficients, basically. Determine when it goes down into a lower state again. So. Yeah. So, yeah.
So when you're
Well, actually, there are, you can almost look at it like a video game, because there are many. Your target is to hit the transonic point at the right place. To have a smooth transition, and actually you can do that with various strategies. For example, you're constrained by the real physics of radiative heating, but you can actually get a smooth transition by, say, expanding adiabatically and getting this cold solution. But then, in order to carry yourself through the transonic point, if you turned on some heating and just had heating near the transonic point, that gives you enough energy to carry on into the supersonic branch. And so you can do it with absorption just on the supersonic side. You can also do it with absorption. On the subsonic side to keep the temperature from going down so much, so that you hit the transonic point at the right place. In other words, you can delay where you hit the transonic point by keeping the speed of sound up, by keeping the temperature up.
It's a rocket making.
Yeah, it is a kind of rocket making business, only with radiation instead of transfer. But the real complication for the realistic case that Casting and Pollock did is that you don't actually know the heating profile a priori, because the heating profile, the radiative heating profile, depends on the density of the gas. And so it feeds back in, and that's probably why they were not able to actually find a converged solution that switches over to the transonic. I had a hard enough time doing it with a simple case. So there's a lot to think about it. Thank you for hanging out. Yeah. I'm having a lot of fun with this.
Is this going in your book?
Yeah, I'm writing it up this week. That's mine.